Welcome to episode 37 of Camthropod, the Cambridge Anthropology podcast. This is Origin Stories Part 3 by Adam Hindon.
Welcome back to Origin Stories. This is the final episode of a three-part podcast investigating the processes by which Cambridge anthropologists come into contact with their field sites. In the last episode, I spoke with Andrew Sanchez, Elizabeth Turk, and Caroline Humphrey about how they ended up working in India, Mongolia, and Russia, respectively. I will begin this episode by sharing my conversation with Dr. Mike Degani about how he came to work in Tanzania.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say the background to that question, which is sort of why anthropology is relevant. I mean, so I generally knew I wanted to do anthropology when I was 17 because I had an opportunity to take an anthropology class in high school, which for Americans is pretty unusual. But it was part of the International Baccalaureate Program for seniors. You could take this anthro elective. So I did. And I kind of loved it. I felt like it was the first class that wasn't really BSing me in some way or other. I felt like it had a real strong sense about power structures and politics. So anyway, I kind of decided then and there that I would do it. And that's as far as I had gotten. But I always really liked lots of other stuff, and part of me thought maybe I'd do English or maybe I'd do history or something like that, or philosophy. I don't know. I was sort of in lots of different directions because I wasn't quite sure how to operationalize this like love of anthro, basically. And then what happened is, I don't know. In college, I had a sort of teacher that I was very, very close with, this woman named Wairumu Jambi, who was from Kenya. And she was like a feminist STS scholar. Like, she didn't really write about Africa at all, per se, or teach about it. But it was sort of in the background, and it certainly informed her way of conceptualizing things. And so I think that kind of planted something in my head, probably. And then when I thought about sort of pursuing graduate education, that was as far as I had gotten. And I thought that, you know, Africa seemed like a pretty interesting place. And then I was at the University of Florida, and I needed a way to pay for graduate school. And basically, you know, and here sort of my biography intersects with like sort of Cold War knowledge formations, but basically there was a foreign language area studies scholarship that I applied for to study Swahili. And I got that, and that was a way to pay for graduate school because UF was not funding every graduate that came in, including me. And so from there, you know, Swahili was spoken in Tanzania, Zanzibar, Uganda, Kenya, you know, a little bit of DRC and so on, Rwanda and Burundi. So that kind of narrowed it down. And then, but from there, I sort of knew that Tanzania had this really interesting socialist history. I'd read a little bit about that, and that kind of piqued my interest. But basically, it had an infrastructure. It had sort of, you know, language study programs. It just had ways. And so basically this sort of institutional configuration pulled me to it. And from there, I was just kind of like kicking around I was taking language classes, and, you know, I knew I was interested in sort of urbanization and development and so on. But basically, like, I was just sort of like trying to get my bearings, and I couldn't really understand much because I was like a second week Kiswahili student. But we were eating dinner with like a host family, and the power went out. And all of a sudden I could actually follow what was happening. I sort of understood what they were talking about or gesturing to. And so from there I started thinking about electricity and electrical infrastructure. And from there I was off to the races. So not like a deep, soulful, passionate thing, but a kind of cumulative sense of intellectual curiosities aided and abetted by institutions.
Next, I sat down with Dr. Tim Cooper to find out how he came to do ethnographic fieldwork in Pakistan.
So I was living in London in 2012. I lived in London since doing my BA. My BA and MA were in film and film production. So I don't come from a background in social anthropology. I was working for kind of, you know, a business, like a company, educational company. And Boris Johnson had just become mayor. And so all of my friends decided to leave London, which was the clearly the most logical thing. And I tried to kind of scope out ways of doing this myself. The company who I was working for had offices in a number of countries abroad. I asked if they had a kind of, you know, openings in one of many regional offices, one of which was in Pakistan. They said, yeah, we've got you know, a role in the Lahore office. Do you want to go? You know, I thought, yeah, that would be fun. I may as well try that. I'd never kind of been to the subcontinent before. I decided to go, which was what was then early 2013, maybe late 2012. But I mean, having studied film kind of theory and production, and I was working for art galleries as well, I was really interested in kind of archives at the time, and circulation and distribution. And one of the ways that I tried to understand this place that I really didn't know much about was through film. This was a really kind of interesting time for Pakistani film history. So the indigenous or the local filmmaking industry, which is called Lollywood, was kind of really waning at this point. Its industrial success was kind of very much faltering. And a few months before I arrived, there was this instance of kind of anti-cinema demonstrations, anti-cinema violence that was provoked by a kind of, you know, a crude and amateur and for many blasphemous film uploaded in the United States, where cinemas were burned. And so film, when I arrived in Pakistan to work, was like a really hot topic. People were talking about the decline of the local film industry, and film and its public morality as well. So the way that I tried to engage with this place that I didn't know much about was through film. So I kind of went to, you know, libraries. I tried to find a national film archive. There isn't one. So I went to, you know, marketplace film traders, some would call them pirates, and asked them about film history and asked them to, you know, recommend me things to watch. And having come from this background in film studies, I realized that as a discipline, film studies isn't always sure about what its object is, isn't quite sure, you know, whether it should talk about its audience, its medium, the materiality of the medium. These are concerns in experimental film practice and in the writing about it. And so, you know, I started to think, talking to people and learning about, you know, the kind of expanded presence of film is a really interesting way of writing and reading and learning more about film. So, which is kind of the way I turned towards thinking about social anthropology. I read works by people who kind of worked on film distribution circulation, like Brian Larkin at Columbia, Lotta Herc, who's in Edinburgh, Chris Pinney's work on photography. And yeah, over the next few years, thought maybe I should do a PhD in this. And come 2017, I'd lived in the country for long enough, on and off, that it was a place that I could go to and felt comfortable going to, and it was feasible and pragmatic to go there. I had a bit of a grasp of Urdu. And so that's how it happened. That's how I did this first project on the relationship between film and public morality by studying among these marketplace retailers who were responsible for, you know, keeping local Pakistani film alive in the absence of a national film archive.
Finally, I talked to Professor Marilyn Strathern about how she came to do fieldwork in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Adam. I think this is a very interesting project that you're involved with. You have to think yourself back to the 1960s. And at a point when the Department of Social Anthropology was dominated by Africanists, you spoke about how there's a particular tenor to ethnographic focuses today. Well, then it was both West Africa and East Africa, and these two segments loomed very large. And I guess the short answer is I went to Papua New Guinea because it was neither West Africa nor East Africa. You also have to know that I became engaged while I was an undergraduate and married immediately after graduating. And during my third year, my fiancé was already working on our prospective field venture in Papua New Guinea. I should probably regret saying field venture. And that we left, we graduated in June and left that November for Papua New Guinea. So that was already in our sight. So if I refer to our and we, then that means my former husband, Andrew Struthen. Now, there was already in the department a Melanesianist, Rayo Fortune. One went to his lectures, but it was a bit difficult to sustain the course. We were on cordial terms, but he never particularly influenced what we did. But nonetheless, he was a presence, and he was a reminder that there was a world outside of East Africa or West Africa, so to speak. Thinking of Papua New Guinea is one thing. Thinking of where, of course, is another matter. And we didn't have any particular yearning to go to uncontacted places or recently contacted places. In fact, initially we were going to go to Orakaiva, where some quite serious anthropological work had been done by F.E. Williams. But we learned that there had been recent volcanic activity and it didn't seem a very sensible choice. Reading around, it then became evident that there was a new arena of interest that was building up, and this was the highlands. And the Papua New Guinea highlands, which is anything above sort of 5,000, 8,000 feet, had been, in quotes, opened up by the Australian administration in 1933, closed down during the Second World War, opened up again in the late 40s, early 1950s, and a decade on from that was in the first flush of early development, as the language was at the time. And the more we read, and particularly, I guess, Andrew Struthen read, because he had more time than I did, the more interesting that arena came. And there were the first early publications, there was a trickle, and it was a tiny handful of early publications on these societies of the New Guinea Highlands. And we, in fact, again made a choice not to go, as we could easily have done, to a really remote place. We decided to go to Mount Hagen precisely because there'd already been in the pre-war, in the late 1930s, work by some missionary anthropologists from the Lutheran Mission in Germany, who had done some really interesting work. So we deliberately chose a place where there already had been work done. Reflecting on your question in the context of decolonization, I've been casting around in my mind as to the kind of atmosphere of the times. I think we chose Papua New Guinea because the language of administration was English, because it was under Australian indirect rule, as it were. Australian was looking after PNG for the United Nations, basically. So that was one aspect of it. We weren't naive about colonization in the sense that today we're not naive about climate change or oil. We know it's there, we know it's in the background, but none of us make major moves to dislodge that infrastructure. We simply recycle our cardboard and go on marches and things like that. In the same way, I think I would have said that our attitude towards the prospect of working in a place that was already colonized was one of amelioration. Like recycling cardboard, you do your bit. In the sense that in the classic liberal mode of, you know, any system in the liberal mode has its internal critique, and the system provides for internal criticism to better enable it to flourish. And that's true of lots of liberal institutions. And Cambridge had certainly had a tradition of helping train people who were going to go into the colonial service in order to give them some education as to what they might be encountering, which of course in retrospect is propping up the colonial service. But the mindset was that you're actually trying to enlighten people and hoping that enlightenment might bring a kind of development or attitudes or behavior towards the people that were being governed. We were fairly conservative, both of us, I think. When we arrived in Mount Hagen itself, we actually paid our respects to the district commissioner. And district commissioner said, that's fine, tolerated us, but didn't want to hear from us. In other words, we could do our studies, but no insurrections, please, and no criticism, please. That changed quite radically over the couple of years that our fieldwork was spread over, and we were sought out for advice on various issues. In fact, later I did some studies of the judicial system that was directly intended for the Law Reform Commission on the verge of independence. I mean, it was a direct sort of applied anthropology contribution. But I remember even in that first spell, I was racking my brains. I think I wrote at least two papers for the administration. One was on child nutrition. They had fastened on nutrition as a sign of these people needing help. I think that the mindset was that you couldn't do much about the fact that this was a colonial regime. You could try to ameliorate some of the effects. I wouldn't want to underestimate the role that theorizing played in all this. I mean, one of the points of turning to Melanesia away from East Africa and West Africa were that the topics that were being written about seemed very different. There seemed to be new perspectives, and there was, of course, we're talking about 1963, I graduated and went out. 1962, Barnes's famous article on African models in the New Guinea Highlands appeared, and it was clear that the Melanesian material was speaking to the older anthropological material in a particular way that made the prospect of re-theorizing very interesting. My supervisor was Esther Goody, West Africa. And under her supervision, she gave me a very African topic. Cash cropping had just begun to raise taxes so that people could pay their taxes, right? People earn money and pay their taxes. I mean, that's what administrations do. One never devises a topic completely by oneself. And what I was going to go out to study was the effect of sibling order, whether you were first born or second born or third born, on business success in cash cropping. Of course, when I arrived there, I mean, the cash crops had hardly begun growing. There's very little money circulating. Sibling order wasn't an issue. That people don't rank, or at least where I was, people didn't rank siblings particularly. And of course, I was overtaken by local events, by gender issues and legal disputes and that kind of thing. But I didn't want you to think that it's all a matter of practical contingencies. There was quite a bit of thinking about possible theories and forms, frames of analysis as well. Yeah.
Field site selection is an incredibly complicated and subjective process that has been largely overlooked in anthropological education. Questions of methodology and theory seem to come into play only after anthropologists have ethnographic encounters, making field site selection a mysterious pre-theoretical and pre-methodological stage in ethnography making. These 9 stories have provided a small glimpse into the sheer diversity of how such encounters are formed and the centrality of the anthropologist as a curious decision maker in such processes. With this in mind, we can see how the entire corpus of ethnographic work to date, and all the knowledge produced from it, ultimately hinges on these personal, serendipitous processes. Our interlocutors, however, do not get to choose who studies them, outside of simply rejecting access outright. By unsettling field site selection, we can cast a more critical eye on the asymmetries between researching and researched communities, and strive to maintain accountability to the worlds we become intertwined with. Thank you very much for listening to Origin Stories and to Canthropod.